What Happened to Me Part 2 by Randall Niles. For further information, materials, and footnotes, go to www.allaboutthejourney.org. The complexity of the simple cell. Each person begins as a single cell, formed by the joining of the mother's egg and the father's sperm. And that single cell contains the digital code to make thousands of other kinds of cells, from fat cells to bone cells, from brain cells to lung cells. There's muscle cells, skin cells, vein cells, capillary cells, blood cells, etc. Ultimately, from that one original cell, the human body will have something like 30 trillion cells conducting an orchestra of different functions. In the first half of this century, scientists, they still assumed that the cell was a fairly simple blob of protoplasm. Without electron microscopes and other technology, the cell was treated as a black box that mysteriously performed its various functions. And it was an unobservable collection of gelatin molecules whose inner workings were absolutely unknown. Then, through the marvels of 21st century technology, scientists now understand that although the tiniest bacterial cells are incredibly small, weighing less than 10 to the negative 12th grams, each is in effect a veritable micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery made up altogether of 100,000 million atoms, far more complicated than any machinery built by man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. Each microscopic cell is as functionally complex as a small city, and when magnified 50,000 times through electron micrographs, we see that a cell is made up of multiple complex structures, each with a different role in the cell's operation. And as we delve further into the cellular world, technology is revealing black boxes within previous black boxes, and as science advances, more of these black boxes are being opened, exposing an unanticipated Lilliputian world of enormous complexity that has pushed the theory of evolution to a breaking point. Wow, that's at the cellular level. If the cell is that complex, what about the simplest organisms made up of these cellular structures? Is there really such a thing as simple? Now that we can view organisms using the latest in microbiological and biochemical technology? If the foundation of today's evolutionary thinking is the first simple single-celled organism created in a prebiotic rock soup, well then, what is a simple single-celled organism? Is there such a thing? Wouldn't any organism, even the first one, have to synthesize fuel, generate energy, reproduce its kind, etc.? Therefore, what's considered simple? I guess a fertilized human egg at the moment of conception looks like a simple single-celled blob no bigger than a pinhead. However, we now know that that amorphous blob contains information equivalent to 6 billion chemical letters, enough complex code to fill 1,000 books, 500 pages thick, with print so small that it would take a microscope to read it. Through the marvel of DNA, every single human trait is established at the moment of conception. Within hours, that single cell, it starts reproducing and grows a cilia propulsion system to move the fertilized egg, which is now called a zygote, towards the uterus. And within 6 days, the original cell, now called an embryo, has reproduced its library of information over 100 times. Ultimately, that original blob of gelatin will divide into the 30 trillion cells that make up the human body. At that point, if all the DNA chemical letters were printed in books, it's estimated those books would fill the Grand Canyon 50 times over. Okay, I don't see anything simple there. But that's a human egg, not a simple self-existing biological entity. So let's get back on track and look at a simple organism that exists in nature. How about a simple bacterium? No, let's just look at one part of a simple bacterium, its motility mechanism. The so-called bacterial flagellum, it's what propels a bacterium through its little microscopic world. That bacterial flagellum consists of about 40 different protein parts, including a stator, a rotor, drive shaft, U-joint, propeller. And through 21st century magnification technology, we now understand that a simple bacterium has a microscopic outboard motor, I mean, the individual parts, they come into focus when magnified 50,000 times using electron micrographs. And these microscopic motors, they can run at 100,000 RPM. Nevertheless, they can stop on a microscopic dime, and in fact, it only takes a quarter turn for them to stop, shift gears, and start spinning 100,000 RPM the other direction. The little flagellar motor, it's water-cooled, hardwired into a sensory mechanism that allows the bacterium to actually get feedback from its environment. This blows my mind. I mean, how does it compare with an outboard motor that I'm familiar with? I mean, was the mechanical motor designed and then manufactured according to engineered specifications? Of course it was. Now make that same outboard motor 1,000 times more efficient and miniaturize it by a factor containing many zeros. The complexity is staggering. Even with 21st century technology, we'll never be able to create a micro machine like this. Michael Behe, he's a biochemist currently teaching at Lehigh University. He coined a term for describing the design phenomenon inherent in molecular machines such as the bacterial flagellar motor. He called it irreducible complexity. Quote, a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. Like a mechanical motor, each part in the flagellar motor is absolutely necessary for the whole to function. Therefore, I couldn't logically deduce any naturalistic, gradual, evolutionary explanation for the existence of even a bacterial flagellum. Besides, no one would expect an outboard motor, you know, whether mechanical or biological, to be the product of a chance assemblage of parts. Outboard motors are designed and engineered. Well, anyway, I just picked one example here. I mean, the bacterial flagellum is only one of among many thousands of intricate, well-designed molecular machines. And furthermore, take these same principles of design and irreducible complexity and apply them to marvels such as the human eye, the ear, the heart, the lungs, the brain. I mean, seriously, how can we logically explain the gradual and random development of these complex systems? What about the human heart? I mean, it's a miraculously efficient, durable, hydraulic pump that no engineer could dream of producing. What about the human brain? I mean, it's a legitimate computer system, 1,000 times faster than a Cray supercomputer, and with more connections than all the computers, phone systems, and electronic appliances on the entire planet. Wait, I remember Darwin saying something about this. Quote, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Okay, using Darwin's own words, let's dig in further and look at one of these complex organs. How about the human eye? The human eye is enormously complicated, a perfect and interrelated system of about 40 individual subsystems, including the retina, pupil, iris, cornea, lens, optic nerve. For instance, the retina has approximately 137 million special cells that respond to light and send messages to the brain. And about 130 of these cells, they look like rods and they handle the black and white vision, and the other 7 million are they're cone-shaped and allow us to see in color. The retina cells, they receive light impressions, which are translated to electric pulses and sent to the brain via the optic nerve. And a special section of the brain called the visual cortex interprets the pulses to color, contrast, depth, etc., which allows us to see pictures of our world. Incredibly, the eye, the optic nerve, and the visual cortex are totally separate and distinct subsystems. Yet together they capture, deliver, and interpret up to 1.5 million pulse messages a millisecond. It would take dozens of Cray supercomputers programmed perfectly and operating together flawlessly to even get close to performing this task. That's so powerful to me. I mean, obviously, if all the separate subsystems aren't present and performing perfectly at the same instant, the eye won't work and has no purpose. Logically, it would be impossible for random processes operating through gradual mechanisms of natural selection and genetic mutation to create 40 separate subsystems when they provide no advantage to the whole until the very last state of development and interrelation. I mean, this represents the core of irreducible complexity. Complex organs made up of separate but necessary subsystems cannot be the result of random chance. Or using the above language, such development could only result from unimaginably small probabilities. And for me, this means statistical impossibility. Come to think of it, I remember Darwin specifically discussing the incredible complexity of the eye in Origin of Species. Quote, to suppose the eye, with all its contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have formed by natural selection, seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree possible. End quote. So how did Darwin deal with the staggering realities of the eye in the 1850s? Well, as absurdly improbable as it was, he followed through with his theory and pointed to the simpler eye structures found in simpler creatures. He reasoned that more complex eyes gradually evolve from simpler eyes. However, this hypothesis no longer passes muster because, well, short of the microbiological and genetic information issues, paleontology now shows that simple creatures emerged in the world with complex structures already intact. Even the simple trilobite has an eye, complete with its double lens system that's considered an optical miracle by today's standards. Wait, the trilobite reminds me of something. Before I continue with the marvel of irreducible complexity and design, I have one more thought about Darwin and his original claims. Let's go back and look at a few more of Darwin's very honest statements. Quote, firstly, why if species have descended from other species by insensibly fine gradations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion instead of the species being, as we see them, well-defined? He also said, but as by this theory innumerable transitional forms must have existed, why do we not find them embedded in countless numbers in the crust of the earth? He went on, lastly, looking not to any one time, but to all time, if my theory be true, numberless intermediate varieties linking closely together all the species of the same group must assuredly have existed. And finally, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Wow, since Darwin put forth his original theory, scientists, they've sought fossil evidence indicating past organic transitions all over the place. Now, nearly 150 years later, there has been no evidence of evolutionary transition found thus far in the fossil record. In Darwin's own words, if this theory of macroevolution were true, we would see a vast number of fossils at intermediate stages of biological development. In fact, based on standard mathematical models, we would see far more transitional forms in the fossil record than complete specimens. However, we see none. Not one true transitional specimen has ever been found. Our museums now contain hundreds of millions of fossil specimens. 40 million alone are in the Smithsonian Natural History Museum. If Darwin's theory were true, we should see at least tens of millions of unquestionable transitional forms. We see none. Even the late Stephen Jay Gould, professor of geology and paleontology at Harvard University and the leading spokesman for evolutionary theory prior to his recent death, he confessed, quote, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology, end quote. He continues, the history of most fossil species includes two features inconsistent with gradualism. Status, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. 2. Sudden appearance. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. Wait, I need to tighten this down. Are there some transitional fossils or none? If Gould uses phrases like extreme rarity and, quote, most species exhibit no directional change, end quote, when referring to the fossil record, that must mean there are at least some transitional specimens, right? Well, author Luther Sunderland, he saw the same issue, so he determined to get the definitive answer from the top museums themselves. Sunderland interviewed 5 respected museum officials, recognized authorities in their individual fields of study, including representatives from the American Museum, the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and the British Museum of Natural History. None of the 5 officials were able to offer a single example of a transitional series of fossilized organisms that document the transformation of one kind of plant or animal into another. The British Museum of Natural History, it boasts the largest collection of fossils in the world. Among the 5 respected museum officials, Sunderland interviewed Dr. Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist at the British Museum and editor of a prestigious scientific journal. Patterson's a well-known expert. He has intimate knowledge of the fossil record. He was unable to give a single example of macroevolutionary transition. In fact, Patterson wrote a book for the British Museum of Natural History entitled Evolution. And when asked why he had not included a single photograph of a transitional fossil in his book, Patterson responded, quote, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be used to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? I could not honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader? I wrote the text of my book 4 years ago. If I were to write it now, I think the book would be rather different. Gradualism is a concept I believe in, not just because of Darwin's authority, but because of my understanding of genetics seems to demand it. Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. You say that I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type of organism was derived? I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument," end quote. Okay, I just wanted to complete the loop. In my research, I haven't found even one transitional fossil. Therefore, based on Darwin's own words, his original theory of macroevolutionary progression didn't happen. Paleontology was a brand new scientific discipline in the mid-1800s, and now, roughly 150 years later, we know that the fossil record doesn't provide the support Darwin himself required. Quote, "Despite the bright promise that paleontology provides, a meaning of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them," end quote. From Dr. Nilsson in Sweden, quote, "My attempts to demonstrate evolution by an experiment carried on for more than 40 years have completely failed. The fossil material is now so complete that it has been possible to construct new classes, and the lack of transitional series cannot be explained as being due to scarcity of material. The deficiencies are real. They will never be filled." Even from Newsweek, quote, "The missing link between man and apes, whose absence has comforted religious fundamentalists since the days of Darwin, is merely the most glamorous of a whole hierarchy of phantom creatures. The more scientists have searched for the transitional forms that lie between species, the more they have been frustrated," end quote. And a final thought, quote, "In the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. These have not been found. Yet the optimism has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into the textbooks," end quote. So what would Darwin say today? Now, after over 120 years of most extensive, painstaking geological exploration of every continent and ocean bottom, the picture is infinitely more vivid and complete than it was in 1859. Formations have been discovered containing hundreds of billions of fossils, and our museums are filled with over 100 million fossils of 250,000 different species. The availability of this profusion of hard scientific data should permit objective investigators to determine if Darwin was on the right track. What is the picture which the fossils have given us? The gaps between major groups of organisms have been growing even wider and more undeniable. They can no longer be ignored or rationalized away with appeals to imperfection of the fossil record. Thanks for indulging my little sidebar. Now back to our 21st century understanding of microbiology, genetics, and design theory. Okay, now where am I with this? Evolutionary theory declares that everything has a mere appearance of design. Richard Dawkins, the author of The Blind Watchmaker and a professor at Oxford, is probably the leading proponent of evolutionary theory since the death of Stephen Jay Gould. And Dawkins writes, quote, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose," end quote. He goes on to say, "The living results of natural selection overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design as if by a master watchmaker." Nevertheless, Dawkins is an atheist who staunchly maintains that the design we see is merely an illusion, that these amazingly complex systems are an accidental product of natural selection. Interestingly, in all other fields of human endeavor, we find that design necessitates a designer. Thus, design detection methodology is a prerequisite for many disciplines, including archaeology and anthropology, forensics, criminal jurisprudence, copyright law, patent law, reverse engineering, cryptoanalysis, random number generation, and SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. In general, we find specified complexity to be a reliable indicator of the presence of intelligent design. Chance can explain complexity, but not specification. A random sequence of letters is complex, but not specified. It's meaningless. A Shakespearean sonnet is both complex and specified. It is meaningful. You can't have a Shakespearean sonnet without Shakespeare. You know, remarkably, the SETI project, that multi-billion dollar effort to scan the cosmos for some indication of intelligence, it's based on one simple notion. If we find radio waves that contain any type of ordered sequence of sounds, then we've discovered intelligence somewhere in the universe. Think about that. The whole premise of these scientists is that you can't have ordered sound, such as the blips and dashes in a Morse code transmission, without an intelligent force behind them. To me, that's huge. So where's this going? It appears to me, if we shed our prior preconceptions and logically examine our organic world, like we do most everything else, we start to see things differently. So how do I connect the dots between the organic and inorganic world? Intelligent design is obvious upon close examination of any mechanical machine. The concept and design inherent in a machine, whether simple or complex, is self-evident. Whether a machine is high quality or low quality, its designer is both necessary and apparent. Information theory states that concept and design can only result from a mind. Even the diminished quality of a poorly constructed machine could not obscure the necessity of an intelligent designer. Back in the mid-1700s, David Hume successfully invalidated the machine analogy in biologic systems because we could only guess as to what existed at the molecular level. However, the phenomenal discoveries in the last few decades have finally and unequivocally demonstrated that living systems are, in fact, machines, even to the deepest molecular level. It has only been over the past 20 years with the molecular biological revolution and with the advances in cybernetic and computer technology that Hume's criticism has been finally invalidated and the analogy between organisms and machines has at last become convincing. In every direction the biochemist gazes, as he journeys through the weird molecular labyrinth, he sees devices and appliances reminiscent of our own 20th century world of advanced technology. Because of the metaphysical implications of life resulting from intelligent design, a surprisingly large number of us seek to reject the foregoing statements and find a mechanism by which complex biologic systems may arise naturally by random chance. However, I'm seeing a tremendous inconsistency here. Quote, "When it comes to the origin of life, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. There's no third way. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago, but that leads us only to one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. We cannot accept that on philosophical grounds, therefore we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance." End quote. That was from George Wald. Sir Arthur Keith, a famous British evolutionary anthropologist, he declared, quote, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable." H.S. Lipson, he wrote, "In fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit with it." End quote. So I'm going to look at this one more time. Could life evolve randomly from inorganic matter? Well, not according to the mathematicians. I looked at them all. You know, Sir Fred Hoyle, he compared the probability of life arising by chance to lining up 10 to the 50th, that's 10 with 50 zeros after it, blind people, giving each one a scrambled Rubik's Cube, and finding that they all solved the cube at the same exact moment. You know, regarding the origin of life, Francis Crick, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Biology for his work with DNA, stated in 1982, quote, "An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to been satisfied to get it going." End quote. Remarkably, right before I finished this chapter, a friend confronted me with proof that life had been created in a random laboratory experiment. And after a little discussion, I realized that my buddy was pointing to the spark and soup experiments of the 1950s, where guys like Harold Urey and Stanley Miller passed mixtures of boiling water, ammonia, methane, and hydrogen through these elaborate electric spark systems of beakers and test tubes. In those experiments, they were able to produce traces of one or two amino acids, the building blocks of life, and therefore the media hailed these as proof for the possibility of spontaneous generation on a prebiotic Earth. Well, there were many unreported problems with these designed experiments. Dramatically, the greatest byproducts of these soups were tar, 85%, and carboxyl acids, 13%, both of which are toxic to living systems. But notwithstanding all the other issues, producing a trace amino acid in a laboratory experiment would be similar to producing a clay brick and declaring that we just figured out how to randomly design and build a New York skyscraper. After discussing a little more of the science stuff, I turned to my friend and I decided to toss him a nice graphic illustration. I said, "Take a frog and put him in a blender and turn the blender on for 7 minutes or until whipped to a frothy consistency." And he stared at me with that kind of look. I said, "Pour the mixture into an open container and place the container in the sun for a few million years. And after a few million years, retrieve the container and examine the contents." I gave him a nod. "Do you have a frog?" He thought for really only a second. "No, you still have frog soup." "You're right," I agreed. "How can you have anything but a soupy mixture containing the building blocks of frog life? With no information code to tie it all together, you have nothing resembling any kind of self-existing organism." Well, in this simple yet graphic illustration, I gave every potential to create a frog. I provided every chemical, amino acid, protein, molecule that makes up the frog's organic structure. However, if I place this illustration in the context of a prebiotic soup on primitive Earth, we'd be lucky to see even one trace element or amino acid develop over the same period of time, let alone the biological components of the entire frog. So where am I? If matter acting on matter for a sufficient period of time can create anything, then I should be able to go out into the mountains of Colorado and find naturally occurring computers, cameras, and cell phones. As we've seen, these inorganic devices are much less complex than a simple organism. Yet, most people would find my statement to be silly at best. I mean, why? Whether organic or inorganic, the complexity in design is obvious. To take this concept to a simple level, I examined the watch on my wrist. Mine's digital. And I contemplated the interdependent system of silicon chips, wires, and LED displays. Actually, by today's technological standard, that's a pretty simple device. However, is there any question that it was created by a group of designers, handed off to a team of mechanical engineers, and then placed into production by a team of automation specialists? Well, then I took a minute to look at the wrist under my watch. I've grown comfortable with its apparent simplicity, but I looked closer at the skin and the hair follicles, and I touched them. And I thought about the nerves that just told my brain to synthesize that touch. And then I focused more closely and pondered the microscopic makeup of each of my cells. And I imagined the complex cellular city at work and contemplated the wonder of my brain that allowed me to imagine such a thing. I thought about the veins just under the surface of my skin, and I thought about my heart pumping oxygenated blood through those veins to keep my wrist and my hand alive, and I thought about my lungs as they inflated, deflated, and processed that oxygen from my heart. Then I flexed my hand, and I pondered the miraculous communication effort that occurred in a millisecond. I created a thought, my brain processed the subconscious instruction and translated it into a task for my body. My nervous system, it delivered that task to my wrist, and my wrist performed the task perfectly. I never really thought about what just happened. How does an interconnected system like that evolve gradually and randomly over time? It goes on and on. My digestive tract, how did that evolve gradually over millions of years? Without processed energy, how would my earliest evolving ancestors even exist? How about my part in a two-part reproductive system? Come on, how did that evolve randomly over millions of years through natural selection and genetic mutation? How do you pass on new and improved genetic traits without the means to reproduce in the first place? I was finally thinking about these things. So out of all of this, I developed a new thesis for my view of life. We need to drop our preconceived notions, dump our presuppositions, just meditate on this material with an impartial mind. Does this stuff have metaphysical implications? Sure it does. But why should that deter us from logically examining the evidence? Where did we get the notion that science and technology somehow have to exist in a naturalistic vacuum? That's not true science. True science is observing the evidence, creating a hypothesis, and testing that hypothesis through various means. Philosophical presuppositions have no place in true science. If science reveals things outside the bounds of known physics, then science should be applauded for its impartial contribution to philosophical and metaphysical thought. You know, for me, logic screamed that someone or something was responsible for life. Now I couldn't go back. To be intellectually honest with myself, I had to go forward and discover who or what caused everything that I see. It could be God, it could be Mother Nature, it could be UFOs, but it was something. I mean, to be honest, I was very uncomfortable. I didn't like the metaphysical implications of what science and technology revealed to me. Evolution was dead. The world did not create itself. Therefore, my comfortable, humanist, materialist worldview also had to die. And since someone or something was out there, logic declared that my relativistic view of things also had to go. And although I was skeptical about my next subject, I had to keep searching. I started reading the various myths and stories and histories about our past. I studied the ancient civilizations. I reviewed maps of the ancient world. I was fascinated by the archaeological evidence. In fact, I had no idea mankind was writing government records, statutory codes, and legal contracts in 2500 BC. I thought ancient history was merely oral traditions of very simple cultures. And then I started reading the so-called holy books. That's the end of What Happened to Me, Part 2 by Randall Niles. For further information, resources, and footnotes, go to www.allaboutthejourney.org. And please continue listening to Part 3 of this 6-part series, What Happened to Me by Randall Niles.